This is a download from the BBC. For more information and our terms of use, go to bbc.co.uk/radio3.
Young friend, you asked me if your verses are any good. The answer is no, not yet. And you knew this because you had to ask. As Rilke said to his own young correspondent, let me ask you to give up all that. Nobody can advise you and help you. Nobody. There is only one way. But then of all the arts, poetry traditionally has the longest apprenticeship. Those youthful geniuses we like to invoke mostly had foreknowledge of their own early deaths. They cultivated their obsession to a pathological degree. It's not enough to sing. You have to have something to sing about, and you don't yet. This takes time, thought, reflective living. So stop asking the question. Ask yourself this instead. Why do you want to be a poet? It's a bad look. There's no money in it. Half go mad and most die 10 years too early. Your life will consist largely of the experience of words failing you, constantly. If it's only because you love poetry, then stop. The world needs more readers, not more poets. And how can you know if you are a poet? All I know is that I've seen men and women destroy themselves because they believed themselves to be when they weren't. The truth is that poetry is not a calling, but a diagnosis. Real poets have as much choice as a dyslexic or a bipolar depressive over their condition. If you feel you can choose, then choose no and rejoice. You're one of the lucky ones. I'm sorry to start this letter so bleakly, but young poets these days have plenty of encouragers, and it's right that once in a while they should hear from jaded, middle-aged miserabilists like me. But if you insist on writing this stuff, it is, I agree, the best game in the world. There are a few things that might help. Firstly, and most importantly, don't ever think of yourself as a poet. You're only really a poet when you're writing poetry, and here's the paradox. This is the time you must be least conscious of being one. Besides, poet describes an activity, like murderer, not a permanent disposition. Unlike other artists, but like murderers, we do other things too. Like murder, we get better at getting away with it. And like murder, early success is important. If your first job is botched, you'll never recover from it. Plan your first published poem like your first assassination. But seriously, all people want to do is find us out. Because to write poetry is the ultimate presumption. It says, I have something important to say. So you better had. In your last letter, you asked if your failed love affair, the nacreous cloud you saw that morning, and the marum grass, made for good subject matter in the poem you then wrote about it all. There are no good subjects. Marum is a pretty word whose appeal 1,000 bad poets have already identified. Your affair, too, is a painful and heartbreaking subject, but you have to learn to leave those poetic objects and events you correctly identify in your life and in the world exactly where you found them, which is the only place they had any poetry. They can't steal a poem, even from yourself. Poem means a thing made, so make it. Subject matter is mere pretext to write about something else, something you hadn't realised you needed to. If you get a good idea for a poem, run a mile, because it isn't one. This isn't the way poems arrive. Mostly our inspirations are not ideas, but generative propositions from which ideas might arise, each time they take a different form. You will find yourself suddenly obsessed with the words blaze and peerless, with the image of a nun eating a lion, with the cliché better late than never in which you suspect an abyss, with a disruption in a rhythm, with the news of the death of a friend from childhood which you know somehow connected with a dark store in which ancient brass instruments are kept, with the final line, I drank the last thing in the house, for which you have as yet no poem, with an anger, a silence, a slip of the tongue. All these things can be places where the unexpected will grow. The key word is unexpected. Despite appearances, humanity is a coral reef, and we're mostly having the same thought. So if you sit down already knowing what you're going to write, stop, because so does the reader. But sometimes we get a strange line or two from the gods, and for free. And then we have to interrogate that given line, like a Kabbalist looking into a line of the Torah, or like a geneticist into a strand of DNA, to divine or backform the whole poem from it. Nonetheless, distrust inspiration. It's real, and you must seek it. But inspiration has given spontaneity an undeservedly good name, and we get greedy for it. Yes, as we always say, it's like getting struck by lightning. And yes, as we always say, we can increase our luck by standing out in thunderstorms. But the darker truth is that you will stand out in thunderstorms flying a kite, or in bad weather, be tempted to summon your own tempest. Poets tend to seek bad weather in their lives, all the while claiming bad weather pursues them, because in good weather there are no poems. The poem you sent me is shapeless. It looks like somebody accidentally spilt it. You've let everything wander into the poem that felt inclined to. It has suffered too little resistance from the foot of the page, from the wavelength of the line, from the episode of the stanza, from the demands of its own music. Remember, form is your friend. Form makes poems both easier and harder to write. Harder, because it'll prevent you saying the one thing you wanted to say, which is often dull, weak and commonplace, and easier, because form forces you to say something else, and in doing so opens a way into the memory, the imagination and the unconscious, which are the only places which can deliver up the shock into wakefulness your reader demands of you. However, remember, your unconscious is your unconscious for a good reason. Close the doors when you leave, or the creatures that should have lived only in your dreams will walk into your waking day, call round in your office hours, or sit down next to you at dinner. I'm not talking metaphorically. As to your innovative use of the semicolon, your job is not to be novel, but original. The truly original idea must be part familiar, so that it can take the reader on a journey from the known to the unknown. Anyone can blindfold the reader, throw them in the boot of the car, then dump them alone in the middle of nowhere. They are rarely grateful for the experience. Show them what they know, but transformed. When we leave the room, we also remove the human torch we were shining into it. Then everything in the room sheds the human dream, sheds its name, its function, and its little story, and is returned to its primal state. Were we able to see the room now, it would look like the tomb of an alien god. Find a way to break back into the room unseen, or a way to see in the dark. Dreams help, and meditation, and drugs, and drink, as does the proximity of death, as does love. You see what I mean about seeking bad weather. Some will encourage you to take risks. By risk, they usually mean formal or thematic experiment. However, this is mostly a very safe activity. The worst that can happen is the reader will get bored or mildly offended. The most fruitful risks will involve writing at the extremes of emotion just before it shades into sentimentality. Writing simply, just before it shades into foolishness, and with prophetic force. Yes, you heard me. Just before it shades into pretentiousness. When you write, you should risk looking like a pretentious fool, or an idiot, or a sap, or a failure. Let me explain. Readers read poetry to take them closer to something powerful and dangerous that they'd not usually be prepared to let themselves feel. They gear up for it. They say, "Now I will read a poem." In Japanese restaurants, great respect is accorded to those chefs who can prepare the puffer fish called the fugu. To qualify, you have to train for years. Most never even get to sit the exam, and even there, 90% of candidates will fail. The reason it takes so much training is not so the chef can learn to avoid cutting into the fish's poison sac. That's easily done. Certainly, if you cut too close, you'll kill the diner. But the reason the diner is there is for the high of the toxin. If the chef can cut it just close enough, a little of the toxin will seep into the flesh of the fish and give the diner the strange sensation they've paid so heavily to experience. So it is with our art. One slip of the knife and the reader will die on you, which is to say, find you stupid or sentimental or ridiculous and cease to trust your voice or close your book. But cut just close enough and they will be rewarded for their investment. So risk by all means. Your reputation should be risked. The reader's mental health should be at risk. Their sleep should be at risk. Their unchallenged assumptions about the world should be at risk. And you should risk failure by walking the highest tightrope you dare. Ah, yes. Have you found your voice? I confess at this point my patience was tested. It's not your fault. You've been told it's important, but it isn't. Do you think Shakespeare ever concerned himself with his voice? All you need to do is shut it up so you can listen. If you listen and then speak, you'll have a voice. The voice will be composed of your own, together with those you've listened to most closely. Choose your influences carefully, and remember the combinatorial statistics. If you choose 4 poets, learn their work by heart, and imitate them mercilessly, no one else in history will have distilled a voice from, say, Marvell, Stephen Crane, Marianne Moore, and Lorca. Just you. And it isn't just about style. Later you'll find that living inside another poet's syntax trains the patterns your own thought will subsequently take. Rilke and Dickinson thought better in higher thoughts than us. The pattern of their thought is set down in the watercourse of their sentences. We can empty them of their words and allow our own to flood them. The poem you sent about the affair and the grass and the sky has too many salient things, which the reader will treat as thematic elements. Death wanders in. Then there's the stuff about the sunset and global warming. Then the doomed child with the eye patch in the last image. Children are always loud in poems. All good lines, all of them, and all nothing to do with the poem you were writing, which has been buried in the confusion. We have to take Occam's razor and then use it to murder our darlings. Only write half the poem, but precisely the half that will prompt the reader to supply the rest of it, which will be coloured with their own interpretation. A poem is like an ecosystem, a complex interdependency between a finite number of agents. A poem is rich not because its elements multiply, but because the sophistication of its relations multiply. Such a poem has harmony as well as melody and creates the rich context in which we can read its symbols. And don't advertise the strange by making it sound strange. If the surreal or terrible or alien thing won't leave your poem, be sure to sing it all the more sweetly. Weave its sounds together. The brain will entertain anything that it's sung to at first, even things it vowed not to let pass. How do you think Orpheus got past that big dog? I'm glad you wrote to me again, but the company of poets is a mixed blessing. You need their community and support and advice, and competition will sharpen your skill. But never forget that poets are not your audience. If you do forget, your poetry will take a reflexive turn and will, in the subtlest but most pernicious way, start to be about poetry. There are too many poets for whom the reader is an inconvenience. Avoid them.